ready to go.
Good. So welcome everyone again. It's great to see so many people. It's actually quite a surprise in the middle of summer, but totally wonderful. So welcome. So I wanted to start first with just getting any comments or questions you might have about the meditation instruction I gave tonight. It was different from what we've done before, and I wonder if some people may already have learned that, if they've been working with an individual meditation instructor perhaps. But if you have any questions or anything, I thought we could just start with that. Or if you have questions about the first instruction, the shamatha mindfulness practice.
It was funny, at some point with the Vipassana, when I'd done some of it before, but when you said just try to be here now, and there was one point where I was like noticing, I was like, wow, it keeps me now, over and over. It was very exciting, like now it's now again, it's now again, wow. Like every moment gets to be now. And it was this like sudden, like you think like, how could I not have noticed that before?
It highlights that,
yeah,
just by that instruction.
Oh, I'm supposed to notice that.
Now.
What's now again?
Right? Every moment's fresh.
Yeah.
Is it the same thing as Vipassana meditation?
Like that's... No, that word, we're going to talk about more about what that word means in this particular tradition. We don't use it in that same way. So the Theravada tradition works with a different instruction. So we use this a little differently. So this particular instruction is different from the Theravada. Yeah, no, it's not the same. And the word insight is also used, and that there are different groups that use that differently. So this instruction is an introduction to this transition that we're making here for this summer program. And we're moving into different territory. We've abandoned using one particular book and kind of focusing on that and using that as an anchor or a jumping off point. However, as I was preparing for this, I was thinking, wow, it would be great if people knew about this, these two books. So we did put it on. I couldn't help myself. So you can take this as experiential learning. Or if you like, this book called Dharma Art, this is an old version of it. The new version is called True Perception. It's basically the same material. The new book has a little more in the back that is a little more explanation. So
it's a smaller format.
It's a different format, yeah. This is the one that was published earlier. And... actually, maybe if people want that, maybe you could bring some copies for sale. Possibly.
If anybody's interested, well,
just let Michael know.
Yeah.
Or you can easily get that.
I can bring some next week.
Right. And the other book that we really would like people to know about is The Profound Treasury of the Ocean of Dharma. And this is teachings by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche from his many years of giving what's called seminaries. I think it was 13. Something like that. But this is volume one, the Hinayana teachings. And the section in here on Vipassana is really excellent. And we'll be using this more in the future, so it will never go to waste. We'll be taking a lot more teachings from this. And we did get actually one copy from the group, the program we went to in Maine, which is we can use as a library copy and loan it.
It is in paperback as well.
It's in paperback. Okay.
And an e-book.
It's an e-book, right. Yeah.
So it's listed on the website.
That's yes. All on the website. Yeah. The titles are on the website. So so this module is entitled Dharma Art, as you saw on that book. So I think that's going to be quite intriguing. And this particular class, this is class one, which I called Vipassana as expanded awareness. So that's what we'll be talking about tonight. So we're going to be exploring new ways of seeing and bringing our meditation practice into the post-meditation experience. So the emphasis will be a little different at this point. There'll be another teacher joining us, Erica Wilton. I think some of you met her. She's been to two classes, and she'll be actually teaching the next several classes. And she's an artist. She studied flower arranging. She's a jewelry maker, and she's actually was a singer at one point. So I think mainly, though, she has a deep understanding of art that has the potential to wake us up. So it's a different take on things. It's not art that is designed or created in a way that people can experience something beyond concept. So we'll get into that more. So I'd like to start this with this handout is online. It's a PDF. It's called Vipassana, the Practice of Awareness, the Freshness of Unconditional Mind. It's the first chapter in this group of several readings. So people can share. I don't think I have enough copies for everybody, but I think what we'll do is actually just read the first part here. And I'll just read it from the book. Oh, I guess we have enough. Oh, then you can pass them down here. How about that, then? Yeah.
Well, I read it, but I don't have one.
Oh, good. Okay. Oh, son. Chow. Son. So I don't usually do this, but I'd like to just read because I think there's so much here that's helpful, and we're moving into a different topic. So having a copy maybe will help you. And then we can talk about different things that are in here. So this section is altogether called Vipassana, the Practice of Awareness. And this first chapter is the Freshness of Unconditional Mind. Vipassana refers to the sense of precision that could arise from the sitting practice of meditation and slowly infiltrate our everyday life. There are two different schools of Vipassana, the analytical contemplative way and the non-analytical experiential way. The analytical school talks about the possibility of becoming more aware if you ask more questions and examine the nature of reality and your own state of mind. In our tradition, in accordance with Jamgon Kontrol, we talk mainly in terms of the non-analytical or experiential approach. Because of that emphasis, the Kagyu tradition is known as the practice lineage. Shamatha provides the ground, but too much emphasis on shamatha practice could be a problem. It is said that one should not be attached to the pond of shamatha, but let the flower of vipassana bloom, like a pond beautified by a lotus flower. Taking shelter in shamatha is a perversion of shamatha discipline. So it is very important to convert the relaxation of shamatha meditation into the post-meditation activity of vipassana. Traditionally, it is said that you should try to achieve a 50-50 balance between shamatha and vipassana. Having properly regrouped your state of mind and linked it with sanity, the post-meditation experience could be a tremendous expansion toward awareness. Vipassana is entirely different from shamatha. Shamatha practice could be regarded as a way of quieting and pacifying the mind. It is a paring down process that leaves us very little reference point and very little to work on except the technique itself. Shamatha is a way to quiet oneself. It is the development of peace. Having already become quiet, having practiced and achieved that basic ground of shamatha, we could expand out and extend ourselves. With vipassana, rather than cutting down our mental perceptions, we sharpen our awareness. Vipassana is referred to as insight, or the seed of prajna, in that we are preparing ourselves to become worthy of listening to the teachings. Through vipassana, we can hear the teachings properly. We are able to perceive the subtlety and the depth of the teachings. That is precisely why vipassana is an important practice. It begins to open the gate of wisdom. Vipassana practice includes the contemplative approach of pondering the Dharma intellectually, as well as the meditative practice of the development of awareness. In the contemplative practice of vipassana, speculative mind is used as a way of looking beyond oneself. You have certain ideas and conclusions, and through philosophical speculation, you try to create further ideas and conclusions in order to transcend yourself. In Buddhist philosophy, you are venturing out into different ground than the ground that you find secure. When you find it very confusing to understand things, then rather than formulating new ideas to make sure you have some ground to stand on, the Buddhist approach is to take a further leap and create your own nest in space. This is the philosophical approach in Buddhism. It is precisely the approach of vipassana, if not prajna. Vipassana awareness arises from several different conditions, but fundamentally, it comes from being without aggression. The definition of Dharma altogether is the absence of aggression. It is a way of dealing with aggression, and shamatha is the starting point. Shamatha brings clear thinking and slows you down, because the only thing you have to work on is your breathing. Because aggression or anger is based on speed and confusion, shamatha leads to the absence of aggression. So shamatha is the development of peace. In order to perceive or to understand the Dharma, you have to develop a state of mind without aggression, a mind based on non-ego and non-speed. Dharma, being without aggression, means the materials of our experience are workable and could be woven into the pattern of the path. It may seem like a tall order to be without aggression, and it may seem impossible for beginners to develop such perfection. However, even for beginners, momentary states of mind occur that have elements of non-aggression and non-ego. There's a lot in there. So I'd like to start with the image of the pond, or we talk about shamatha's pool. So it's interesting that, you know, we study and we practice something, and then we say there might be danger in this approach, which means we could feel very settled in our practice. We could feel like this is a comfortable place to be. And we could be stuck in that approach. So the pond is, I think of it as like an inlet where there's no, kind of in the Charles River, there's these little places that the water seems to get stuck and the things are starting to grow and you feel like it's going to fill in over the years. So that's the kind of the quality of this shamatha pool. And the flower is vipassana, let vipassana bloom. And this traditional image in the East of the lotus, which is also in the Charles River, the lotus, the American water lily, is growing in the mud. So it's seen to be this beautiful thing that comes out of the mud, and it opens petal by petal. There's a slow opening of the flower of the lotus. And that image is one of then making a connection to the world, of opening to compassion. It's an image for compassion. And you'll see, you go on different websites and you'll see when they have, they'll have, may have a Buddhist website, will have a statue of the Buddha, but they often have a lotus. So you can think of that image as one of actually opening to compassion for others. So what's being pointed to here is this process of, or you could say this progression, when we sit down to meditate, you may think, well, I have so many thoughts, I don't know what you're talking about. There is no calm pond in my life. There's no pool that I can recognize here. But when you practice more, you find that, you can find that space. And that can be a place where you can go, oh, this feels good, I'm not going any further. But that can be a little bit of a trap. So the idea here is actually expanding into a bigger world. And that is the quality of awareness and of vipassana. And vipassana is seen to be actually more of a post-meditation experience. I mean, there is this quality of transition from our shamatha to vipassana meditation practice, which includes more space and more awareness. But there's also the quality of bringing this practice, your practice of meditation, into your everyday life, into everything you do, into just that every step you take. Somehow that line from some music fell into my head. That quality of everything you do could actually be joined with your meditation practice. So the Vipassana experience or the Vipassana training is one that helps us bridge that gap and open into that sense of bringing our practice much more widely into our daily life. The quality of non-aggression is actually very important here. And you can imagine that with shamatha, as we practice, there's a quality of calming down, there's a sense of settling, kind of cooling off the anger, you could say, or the upset or the turmoil. Those are all part, that can be all part of that process. So from that quality of working with your mind, becoming familiar with things that kind of throw you off, then there's actually a sense of natural transition to this expansion, which I find quite curious, actually, that it's not really something you crank up or you try to, you don't really make it happen in a way. It just starts to happen through your own practice and through settling into this, to the shamatha practice, the opening to vipassana just begins to come. And part of that is also more clarity. You start to see your mind more clearly when you practice. And I think people have that experience of, oh, I've thought that thought at least 5 times in the last hour. You start to notice what your mind is doing. So there's much more awareness at that point as well. So that's carried forward as well. So, let's see, where did I put my notes here? Let's see where we are with that. So the other aspect is what we've been talking about all along, which is the development or the realization of this gap and the space of the non-ego that we start to have a connection with, we start to realize, that comes from that. And this gap that we talk about in our practice as well is what's talked about in this little write-up as the seed of prajna. And this is the seed of insight or noticing from this space. So maybe I'll stop there and we'll continue. But so maybe you have some questions about some of the things I've said, which is just a kind of beginning here.
I have a question. Does Vipassana translate as spaciousness?
Well, in Tibetan, it translates as lakthong, lakthong, which is superior or special seeing. So it's something that's becomes a sharpness or a way of seeing that's more precise or clear. So you start to notice things in a different way.
What is the word for spaciousness? Isn't there one that's
Shunyata is emptiness. That's emptiness. Yeah.
Okay. And then how does shunyata then this connection there?
that's part of it too, but that's a further development. So I'd say this is sort of I see it in more of a step here. Would you agree with that? Or do you see
we have gone into discussing shunyata already. We discussed where it works, how it works, and we've discussed egolessness of self and egolessness of other or egolessness of phenomena. So this is the actual practical step you take in terms of developing clear seeing, and this clear seeing leads to, we talked about a little bit, prajna. Which is this faculty of the mind which is capable of perceiving reality.
So there's a progression there.
Spaciousness and egolessness had to be a part of the Vipassana?
They are. I mean, it's in there, but it's sort of like how do you move, how do you explain it, or how do you go from one step to another? So this training, and we're actually going to go into a lot more in the fall, I think, on the development of ego, which will, I think, help people a lot, because a lot of questions, development, well, how ego develops.
Okay.
Therefore, we'll know how to take it apart when we know what the pieces are. So enjoy the summer, let me tell you. If you thought the last book was bad. We just want you to have fun this summer. So we'll keep you coming back at least for another 6 weeks.
I'm curious about the prajna.
Yes.
Is Vipassana like the practice of clear seeing, and the prajna is the product or where the quality that is produced from the practice?
It naturally arises in the context of Vipassana.
Yeah, so the
in
chicken.
Other words, it's an aspect of, we're talking about entering into the preliminary dimensions of awareness.
And where is, I'm just,
mm-hmm. Go ahead.
A complicated question.
Yep.
So I'm just used to hearing a lot about insight.
Right, right.
And things like that. Is there a rough, quick, and dirty way of saying how that relates to
the insight that you've, do you go to the insight meditation? So, I'm not as familiar, with those techniques, but my limited understanding is that they work first with a much more interior process of working with kind of where feelings are in the body and an inner quality of that. But those teachers of insight have gone a lot beyond that particular tradition to Dzogchen, because I've seen them at programs I've gone to, and I know, and so I think that their initial teaching was Theravadin, and that's a very much more of this kind of working closer in with your sensations and knowing where you're feeling things in your body. And they're also, I don't know what they're teaching to their groups, but I know that they're also studying more teaching in the Dzogchen tradition. So it's a different...
One of the things that you're beginning to see in your practice is the patterns of mind. You begin to see your thoughts arising and dwelling, or when you actually can't find them, of course, when you look, but you still see the process of arising, dwelling, and ceasing. So this is definitely an aspect of what we would call Vipassana.
So it's observing the process.
Actually, or even investigating, where there's actually a conscious investigation of the origins and the dwellings and the articulations and the final disappearance of your processes that make your wallpaper, which makes you say, "This is me." You know.
So that's the other side of it. There's the analytical, more analytical side, and we'll be going more into that too. So we're taking it more from the experiential for the first part. Hold on, Roberta. Just Michael, did you say?
Yeah, I think that what you want to know is whether eggs produce chickens or chickens produce eggs, and they do.
or just that chickens and eggs are somehow related in a way.
They are related in that chickens produce eggs and eggs produce chickens. That's how they're related, okay?
Yeah.
It's very clear.
It's intertwined.
Yeah. Okay, so right now what Emily's working on is how can we wipe our sensory organs so clean with the passion that we begin to see the world in a brighter way.
Just what is prashna again? Is it wisdom?
Yes, it's wisdom. It is wisdom, that's true. So there's higher prajna and lower prajna. And lower prajna is sort of how you know how to get things done.
Villages on that circle thing.
Oh, villages on the... Oh,
the wheel.
The wheel. The wheel. But it is wisdom, or sometimes it's translated as insight or clear...
I'm thinking somehow that I remember like these were the parts of bodhicitta, the three parts of bodhicitta, I thought.
We did talk about prajna. We talked about that in terms
clear
of...
seeing,
yes.
Intelligence, the wisdom, and I forget the beginning one.
Right, and it's all connected with compassion.
Right.
What was the first one? Was compassion? Okay, I'll look back.
Go back and look.
I'll look.
Thank heavens, it's all online because I never remember it.
Sheila Samadhi.
That's it. Sheila Samadhi.
Discipline, meditation, and prajna, knowledge.
Knowledge.
Right. The prajna is a very flexible term, and we encounter it in the very initial stages of our practice, and then we find it, we take it even out of the Hinayana, or what we call the self-liberation phase, into the phase of basically liberating everything, and the Mahayana path.
It seems to me that some transition you're talking about is we're now not considering a flash thought or a clear thought or maybe an awareness, not as a distraction, but as something else, something to be retained, you know, in sort of a memory thing. But then do we avoid a storyline? You know, do we then sort of, I think Trungpa says, just acknowledge it and keep on?
Yeah, we're not working with the storyline here.
We always disown.
We disown.
We can see it. It's important to see it, but we're not basically hanging on to it. We're not holding anything.
So what's the difference then? To me, the difference seems to be in shamatha. We were saying if a thought occurs, we acknowledge it, and it's more of a distraction from concentration on the breath.
It's not a distraction. It's just what happens. So it's not seen. A distraction sounds like you shouldn't be doing it. But the mind keeps going. So that's the thing people need to know. That's what happens. So here's an image that came to me when I was thinking about this. Okay. What's an image? I like images. That's how I understand things, through images. So it makes it easier for me if I can come up with something. So what I was thinking about, and I've used this before for shamatha, it's like a picket fence. So you have a slat, and then that flash of awareness, so there's a gap, right? You can see through the fence. Then the thought comes up, and you're back into the picket fence. Then there's another space. You could say, when you realize that you're thinking, you're already back. Michael says this over and over, so I'll have to say it, so get it on the tape. I want to be sure to get that in. So you're already back, but that's the flash of awareness. And it's not a light bulb. I know that people got confused with that. There's the flash of awareness means a split second. You notice, and then you disown the thought, and you're back with the breath, which is the out-breath, the gap. So then you have another gap in your picket fence. And the more you do that, the more gaps you get, and the more, sometimes the bigger they get. This is a little too concrete. But you can think about, you know, shamatha, you're grounded. It's like the earth. Then if you are looking through this fence and you're at the ocean, you're in a boat, sailing a boat, and you're feeling the wind, you're smelling you can feel the moisture come off the ocean, you can sort of taste the salt almost come up in the air. You're watching the light sparkling on the waves and the wind's blowing. So you're just moving through space in your sailboat, and you have a sense of this grand of being in a larger environment, an expanded space. But you're also working with your sailboat, and you need to know which way the sails are going and which way the wind's going. So there's a quality there of mindfulness. If you forgot all that, your boat would tip over. So you can see from the picket fence, which is pretty definite, and there's a sense of a tether there. I like that word for shamatha, because the breath is like a tether. It's bringing you back. You have like a stake in the ground. But vipassana, you're sailing now. There's a much more of an open, wide world. And this practice of vipassana brings us into a world where the senses, our five senses, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and hearing, actually are our connecting points with this sacred world. The way we can actually experience it and use the senses in a way of waking up are through some of these experiences that we want to share with you, having to do with, for instance, Erica is going to do flower arranging, Ikebana, Japanese flower arranging, and talk about these principles within that, as well as the experience of seeing it and also looking and working with the gaps, because it's really the space of the flower arrangement is more important than things that actually hold it. In fact, it's not about flowers at all. We'll find that out. But and also other ways of actually using our senses to wake up. So what we're moving towards here, there's a chapter, the third chapter in this section is really excellent. So I do recommend, if you get a chance to read this section on Vipassana in the Profound Treasury. It's called The Art in Everyday Life. And this is about how to wake up in your life every moment. That it's not that we just go and meditate and then that's it. You know, we forget the whole thing and then maybe we come back the next day for 10 minutes or 20 minutes and then we forget it to the next day. It's that 24 hours a day almost, you can actually use your experiences in your life to wake up. And that's where we're heading. This is called Sacred World. So that all of our experiences have that potential to wake us up. But what we want to present here in the next several weeks is ways of doing things that may kind of surprise you or put you on edge, perhaps, which will be fine. You know, you just jump in. Yes?
So, thank you for the imagery.
You're welcome.
Does that relate to rest in Alaya?
Alaya.
Mm-hmm. Alaya, okay.
So we studied the Lojong teachings, and that's wonderful to bring those up. They're really fabulous. So this is mind training. And the first slogans are about this primordial open space. So there's just different ways of approaching or talking about it, because it seems so, well, how do you talk about it? How do you connect with it? So the first slogans in the Lojong are the absolute slogans, and that's rest in Alaya is one of them, and that's a very good thing to bring up.
Okay. And the nature of unborn awareness is, I think, like, maybe the next one after that, or very close.
And right.
Also relates.
Let me go to this section on the art of everyday living, because I'd like to make a transition between what we're presenting here and actually Dharma art. And that will be more the topic next week. In fact, next week we're not doing the Ikebana next week. That'll be after. Next week we're going to show a video of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. It's a series, but we're going to probably do talk 2, which is called It's Visual Dharma. I think it gives some very good explanation and principles of what we're going to be working with. And then the week after that, we'll have flower arranging. So, let's see, page 343. So this is from chapter 45, The Art of Everyday Living. Vipassana practice brings an appreciation of art in the sense of artfulness, or how to handle ourselves in body, speech, and mind. The practice of Vipassana includes the study of movements and interactions. And actually, when we think about it, the whole aspect of moving towards Mahayana is communication, working with others, and interacting. So you can see that transition where we're heading. As a result of shamatha practice, we develop a sense of being. And as a result of vipassana practice, we develop confidence in how to be. Awareness practice is highly...
Can you read that sentence again?
Okay. From that last sentence?
Yeah.
As a result of shamatha practice, we develop a sense of being. And as a result of vipassana practice, we develop confidence in how to be. Awareness practice is highly psychological. The appreciation of mind brings an appreciation of everyday life. Vipassana brings new material into our life and provides a way of relating with the material that we already have. In awareness practice, all of that could be used and worked with, and we find that we are surrounded by all sorts of possibilities of expressing and experiencing our artistic talent. By the way, you don't have to have any artistic talent, so don't worry. There is a difference between the shamatha and the vipassana approach to the art of living. In the case of shamatha, we are developing an acute and precise mindfulness. Although we are just touching the verge of the breathing and there is a quality of freedom, there is still a feeling of duty and restriction. The tension of being mindful may be very light. Nevertheless, we are still placing a demand on ourselves. In contrast, vipassana is based on appreciation. Nothing is hassling us or putting demands on us. Instead, we simply tune in to the phenomenal world, both inwardly and outwardly. So in Vipassana, the idea of the artist is very important and necessary. Through Vipassana, we begin to appreciate our surroundings in life, whatever they may be. They do not have to be good, beautiful, or pleasurable. In Vipassana, we are able to see the uniqueness of everyday experience every moment. We might be doing the same thing every day. We brush our teeth every day, comb our hair every day, cook our dinner every day. But that seeming repetitiveness becomes unique every day. In Vipassana, a kind of intimacy is happening with our daily habits, so that as we go through the day, our life is a work of art. That is why I call Vipassana art in everyday life. I think that's great.
The art of toothbrushing.
The art of toothbrushing. Yeah, right. We're not trying to make money off of that, are we?
The fact that repetition, you know, repetition is key,
right.
It feels like. Because repetition is something that we could both take for granted,
mm-hmm.
but also when we do something repeatedly, it actually can bring us to another state of consciousness, I think.
Yeah, if we use that
as a
platform, as it were, to actually just open us.
Yeah.
So when we got the initial instructions today, just basically flashing out on right now, just being here. And then when we're here, we discover this freshness, which is absolutely direct. I mean, it's incontrovertibly fresh.
Right.
So even if we're doing repetitive things, like really grinding away, there could be some kind of absolute original state in that process that we can discover.
Yeah.
It is important.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, you can wash your dishes totally mindlessly, which, you know, mostly I do. It's a good chance to think about something. Or you could actually be present. You could feel the sponge. You could feel the temperature of the water. You could actually notice the bubbles in the soap. Children are like this. They have a freshness. Like, they could stand there and look at a snowflake or a bubble. Everything is interesting. You could actually... I was thinking that today when I was sitting on the porch and I looked up and I said, wow, I never noticed there were reflections on the glass of the window when it's open. You know, it's one of those, you know, bluebird ones. So I was looking and it's like, and it's not just the trees, it's how the light is. And you, it's that moment of seeing something that you never saw before because you already know it's there. So why would you look, you know? But this is the awake quality of Vipassana. And we can actually experience this open, spacious quality at any point, at any moment, anything we're doing. We can just stop, or just, you don't even have to stop, you can just be aware at that moment.
It's sort of like if there are places you always drive, and then one day you decide to like walk along there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that slowing down and looking. You're like, well, I don't have to look at the road. I can look at, wow, there's a really cool house. It couldn't have gone up just today because it's
right.
A house. But I never looked at that before because I wasn't taking it. I was...
Right. That's a good example.
I mean, what this brings together for me is in the earlier reading, he talks about how he equates speed with aggression.
Mm-hmm.
And... I thought that was odd. And yet, sort of rushing past stuff, and sometimes we have to, but rushing past stuff is a way of ignoring it or shutting it out or closing off some part of awareness. So that begins to make a little sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know if this pertains to this, but I think it's the same for me in physical exercise, stretching. Become so much more aware of your body when you're doing stretching or yoga, and even afterwards there's a retention of that awareness after you get up and walk away. And one of my least favorite but best exercises is holding plank, and you never become more aware of your breath. It's like a 10th minute of holding plank.
10 minutes? Whoa, I'm just working up to one.
And you become so utterly aware of everything. Inch of
yes.
your body at that
yes.
moment, and then afterwards, you pick yourself up off the floor. The feeling, though, that your body retains is you're still so happily aware of every inch of your body that was involved in that exercise.
Mm-hmm.
So, as opposed to having that external awareness that brings in the self.
Mm-hmm.
I think the second breath, you know, in sports.
Yes.
It's like that. I knew when I was swimming, I hit a point in which, you know, I get that second breath, and
mm-hmm.
that was
yeah,
a relief.
Second wind, right?
And mm-hmm. a second wind.
Or runners high.
Then the rest of the swimming was easy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, another level of consciousness as well as the body itself was undergoing some sort of change. So I never won a race, but I love practicing it.
Well, I think the non-competitive aspect of just doing it, though, is actually better because you're not driven to a point. You're not driven to beat the person in the lane next to you.
Mm-hmm.
You're simply in it for that feeling, that moment.
Yeah.
Especially in swimming,
yes.
with the regulation of the breath.
Right. Right. It's so the next section after what I read, it's called Aggression is Anti-Art. So that's, as you mentioned, John, that is just, that whole, does that make sense to people about the aggression and the speed? How, when we're doing that, you can see how we're caught up in self, right? That's a sense of that fixation, I've got
to
go there, or
I need,
so it's, there's no space to actually experience and to be receptive to what comes to you. And then, so we're talking here again about this opening to opening the lotus and this opening to compassion. You can't have compassion without being aware of other people. And it's all about this communication. And awareness. So the art, which is interesting, the way Trungpa Rinpoche talks about art, is it's communication, but if it comes from ego, from the artist, there's something you can pick up on, that there's a quality of it's more shut down, and the communication, it doesn't take the viewer to that, you could say, that primordial space or that openness. I don't know how to describe it. It's really beyond words, and that's why we're working with the material we're going to do, because it's beyond concept. And that's how we left off our last book that people really hated. Not really, but it was hard, I know. But this is, it's different because it's really beyond concept, but you can experience it. And I know for myself, it's interesting, I had this experience a while back when they had the Monet show, long time ago, it was Haystacks at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago or something. And I just remember standing in front of this picture, this painting of the Haystacks, which he did at different times of day, different light, and just looking at this picture. And then the whole thing was just, the light was completely alive. And it was like, I felt like I disappeared. I really did. It was a sense of just being somehow beyond the picture, or in the picture, who can say. But so I think that's, we're talking about experience. Did you have something to say?
I was just amazed by your talk.
You're welcome. Chow was in the program at in Maine that Michael and I went to, the Profound Treasury, which is from this series, and that was your first year coming,
yeah.
Right? And you found it online,
yeah.
I think, from Beijing.
Yes.
And here she is, and came to the program. It was wonderful.
Wonderful experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Steve Kehoe.
And Steve.
Was also at this program with us.
And Steve's been studying with Michael Fagan these teachings from the Profound Treasury. So that's another aspect of what we're trying to think about, is how to bring people along. And perhaps some people in our group would like to go to that program. It will be, we agreed to rent the space at Ferry Beach, the Unitarian space, in Saco, Maine, for 5 years, we have an agreement that we can use that space. So we could actually start to bring people along in these teachings, so you could take advantage of that and go to that program. It's a 9-day program. I mean, that's what it's been, a 9-day program. And there's a way of preparing, because they're online. Each year is recorded, and there's online teachings of Judy Leaf, who's the editor of this book. She basically put this together, and she's the teacher at those programs. So we're trying to figure out, you know, we'd like to bring people along, so if they're interested, they could actually join into that. So we'll work on that, too. Any other questions about or comments?
Yes. One thing to add just about retreats in general, not anyone in particular, but you talked a little bit about kind of bringing awareness into everyday life and even kind of the little things that you do. And I found, I mean, there's no container better than a retreat where that just kind of naturally happens. It's like you're in this place, you're sitting most of the day, you're eating your meals, you're brushing your teeth, you're not really doing anything outside of normal activity other than maybe sitting more than you usually would. But everything becomes really heightened and fresh, you know, even very simple things. So I highly encourage, even if it's just a weekend or doing something like the 3-hour sessions on the weekend, like getting immersed more in that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. This will just kind of, that's the thing, it's not really a forced experience. It just kind of naturally arises, almost like when I'm like out looking over a lake at a sunset. I'm not like labeling that the sun or that's the trees. It's just there's some kind of inherent freshness and very clear image without having to bring concepts.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a great description.
Yeah. Yes, actually, I couldn't agree more with Steve's points, because the retreat, at least from my experience, the retreat I can get from that is those experiences, those awakened experiences, and those, like you said, your heightened freshness. Actually, that's we can bring into our normal life when we're working, when we're doing our housework. Actually, at this point, we're fighting with our working with our habitual patterns. Those are the quality of confusion. But those experiences we have in retreats, that's really precious, because that can constantly remind us and the way we can work with our habitual patterns. And those habitual patterns include ego, includes the conflicting emotions, includes those consciousness we don't know how to deal with. Sometimes we got we got panic, we got something we did, we regret, and we want to confess something. But those things are just what we then work with. And we have those precious experiences that we can constantly reflect on ourselves and look into that and investigate into our experience, and constantly reminding us to come back to the awakened experience. So that's the point of going to a retreat. So from my experience, I definitely encourage you guys to come to a retreat like that.
So we'll have mini retreats, these little ones in July. We have 3 weeks in a row on Sunday from 9 to 12. So it is a really precious opportunity. And I think, you know, we have our practice here, but it's when you really have a chance to sit longer, there's just more opportunity to kind of wear things out. You have to wear it out. Roberta.
Will the retreat this Sunday be part shamatha and part vipassana, or does it matter?
You can do, that's a very good question. So in terms of the instruction that I gave in the second part of the meditation practice today, that you can use the vipassana in your daily practice. So it's said that you can, you're your own best meditation instructor. So when you sit down to meditate, you can look at your mind, and even before you begin, think about, okay, am I crazy today? Am I just, you know, like all over the map? Okay, well then I need to really just be here, work with my breath, bring my gaze a little in, and just be here. And then you can say, okay, at some point, maybe on that day or another day, you could actually just raise your gaze and rest and work with the Vipassana open practice. You can start that way if you wish, or you can start with the shamatha. There's nothing, like Tonglin, we always encourage you to have the shamatha and then Tonglin and then the shamatha, because Tonglin practice can bring up a lot. So the shamatha helps us work with it. This isn't the same thing. You can use this at any point.
So it'll be part of the retreat.
It won't be mentioned. You just do it.
Okay.
You do it when you want to. Yeah. So the retreat on Sunday, the format will just be sitting for a period, and then walking, and sitting, and then walking, and then sitting. And there'll be a chance for meditation instruction if you want. And you can just let Kathleen know. And actually, all three of us will be here this Sunday, and we can meet with you. We have space here to do that. Or you can just sit the whole time, do whatever you want. So it's up to you. But you can let us know.
You can also only sit a part of it. I mean, you don't have to necessarily feel like I can only come if I sit 3 hours. You can come and sit for an hour. That would be great.
Right.
That's good too. So
right.
Don't be discouraged about the time.
Right. We encourage you to come at the beginning because it works out. It's just generally better than having people sort of enter over and over. So if you can come at 9, that would be good.
So just for practical for the Vipassana.
Yep.
The gaze is up instead of down.
Right. Yeah.
And is there just a sort of awareness to everything that comes up internally and externally? Just everything goes, or is it more about focusing on the outside world?
Well, you're not really focusing on anything. You're just with whatever comes up.
Yeah.
So let's say you have an itch. Well, it's not that, okay, you're only going to pay attention to what's, you know, in front of you or something. You may have a cramp and you need to adjust your legs. So that actually could be part of your practice. You're aware of it and you do what you need to do. And your gaze is out and you're present in the moment, in the space, and there may be something else that you notice in your body. You're not really actually trying to emphasize anything in terms of paying attention to your body the way the insight meditation teaches. So
it's just whatever is in your field.
And you're not really looking at anything either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your gaze is out, but you're not wandering with your eyes.
You're not wandering. Right.
It's right ahead. Yeah.
So like today I was sleepy.
Yeah.
I was doing it, and so I was just
Mm-hmm. But actually, that's very good you brought that up. It's perfect, because actually the shamatha and vipassana really work together. That's another instruction. Mm-hmm. The when you're sleepy, having your eyes open and looking straight out is a way to brighten up your world. In fact, there was a moment that the light seemed brighter.
Yes, it did.
I was like, did I imagine? I thought, wow, I must be enlightened. Oh. This is really working. Oh, I planted that, so you all get a sense, you know, you're making progress. Well, anyway, too bad. But, yes, so work with the sleepiness. Just, you know, your eyes are open and you're just there. So if your mind is wild, then lower your gaze. So that is a general instruction. Lowering your gaze and drawing in to a closer 4-foot range or something helps you stabilize. So there's the stability aspect, stabilizing your mind, and then this awareness aspect. So it's The point is, don't be jumping back and forth because you're bored. That's not the point, obviously. So you can work with it. You can experiment and see. And it's really important to have some stability in your shamatha practice. That really, you know, before you do the vipassana. But you can do whatever you want. I mean, experiment. It's okay. Nobody knows what's going on.
The thought police.
The thought police. Any other questions? Those were great questions. Okay, we'll dedicate the merit.